This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. This hour, uncomfortable conversations during this long, hot summer. As crime spikes in cities across the country, one retired cop talks about where the conversation about policing and violence need to go. Also, a call to Catholics from Pope Francis, taking on issues that have long been considered uncomfortable for the church, including abortion. And we're talking tech and love. Does your smartphone make you avoid real conversation altogether?
Hi, this is Hillary Smith from Cotati, California. My husband and I do have similar tech habits, plenty of online shopping, but no Facebook or social media. We just moved to and have agreed to keep all screens out of the bedroom.
All screens out of the bedroom. What about screens out of your relationship entirely? Have your say. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. A lot more on that conversation later this hour. But we begin in Washington, where President Obama appears now to have secured enough votes to guarantee the Iran nuclear deal. On Tuesday, two more Democratic senators, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and Chris Coons of Delaware, pledged their support for the deal. And then earlier today, retiring Democratic Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski said she's on board. And that makes 34 senators in support, enough to guarantee that Congress can't override a veto if lawmakers were to block the deal. Here's Senator Coons in a speech at the University of Delaware on Tuesday.
We cannot trust Iran, but this deal, based on distrust, verification, deterrence, and strong principled multilateral diplomacy, offers us what is today our best remaining opportunity to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon.
So three more Democratic holdouts are on board, and with the vote approaching in mid-September, it now looks like it could pass without a single Republican in the Senate or the House voting for it. Amber Phillips, political reporter for The Washington Post, says it's been a slow, steady push to reach that magic number of 34.
When the deal was announced in July, by my count, we had one Democratic senator supporting the deal, pledging to support the deal. The rest were kind of undecided. But yet, week by week, we've seen two senators supporting the deal, three senators supporting the deal. And as you mentioned, the magic number here for the president to keep his deal is 34. And I think what's been going on is the president has engaged in an intense lobbying effort. You know, you heard Senator Coons yesterday announce his support. He mentioned that morning he got a handwritten detailed note from the president trying to assuage his concerns about the deal. So the president has been going all in for this victory.
And the concerns on the part of Democratic senators have been real, not cosmetic. There have been two senators who said they won't support it. High profile Chuck Schumer, the next Democratic leader of the Senate, Bob Menendez, the top Democrat or the former top Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. But Amber, we may be at the point now where the president won't even have to veto a resolution of disapproval. It might not even have enough votes to get to his desk in the first place. Nobody expected that.
Nobody expected that, you know, especially when you look at the lobbying effort against the deal. You know, very powerful pro-Israeli groups have been putting tens of millions of dollars into Democrats to try to get them to join Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez to not support the deal. That just hasn't worked. And like you said, when Senate Democrats do come out in support of the deal, or any Democrat, they mention how tough this decision has been for them, that they've been going to, you know, dozens of briefing meetings. Senator Bob Casey wrote an 8,000-word memo yesterday in explaining his decision. And I think that's a reflection of how unpopular back home this deal has become. You know, we've seen a Quinnipiac University poll on Monday that said 25% of Americans support the deal, just 25%. So this is a really tough vote for Senate Democrats, and yet they're taking it.
And whether or not the fact that only 25% of Americans support the deal translates to somebody voting against you because you made a mistake, you know, the kind of vote like the Iraq War authorization, that's a totally different story. However, the White House winning its fight to get Senate and House support for the Iran nuclear deal. Amber Phillips, reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
What's next is a big question looming over President Obama if he does indeed get the votes he needs in September for this Iran deal, as we've been discussing. Ambassador Nicholas Burns is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a former Undersecretary of State. He's testified several times in favor of the agreement in congressional committees. But Burns says that the Republicans do have a point. In 10 to 15 years, Burns believes that Iran could emerge more powerful and that President Obama and his successors have a lot of work ahead of them to make sure that doesn't happen.
It's been a fascinating debate on Capitol Hill. I testified before four of the committees and heard the complaints. I think the Republicans had the advantage in July because they were nearly unanimous in condemning the nuclear deal with Iran. And the Democrats laid back, and many Democrats were wavering. They were under tremendous pressure in their constituencies. But I think in the end, President Obama and Secretary Kerry have been able to make one compelling argument. What's the alternative? What's the alternative to a negotiated agreement that has been underway for 2 years that every other major country in the world supports, and that's going to freeze Iran's nuclear program for 10 or 15 years? And I think it was that argument, that walking away, which was a Republican argument, and hoping for a better deal later, it just simply wasn't practical. I think the debate turned on that issue, and now you've seen this cascade of Democrats coming forward to support President Obama.
And you've made that very argument in all of those hearings, which I watched and attended. You made that very argument to lawmakers that the deal is far from perfect, there are significant concerns, but that the alternative is far worse, or that really there is no alternative. So going forward, you've been writing about what President Obama should be doing, given a very imperfect deal, to reassure allies and strengthen the United States' position vis-a-vis a recalcitrant Iran going forward here. What are some of your recommendations?
I support President Obama, that this is the right deal for us. But the problem with the deal, and there are some downside risks here, is that after about 15 years, during which time Iran's nuclear program will have been frozen, at 15 years, most of those restrictions are taken off Iran. So theoretically, Iran could reconstitute a civil nuclear program. It could use that as a cover for a military program.
President Obama has said rhetorically many times that Iran cannot be allowed to get a nuclear weapon and that he won't allow it. Are you arguing that he needs to make a change, not just in rhetoric, but in doctrine, that the United States take a different posture about a nuclear Iran and how it will respond if Iran cheats?
I do think that is the right way forward. There have been isolated statements by President Obama in the past, including one just a couple of weeks ago. But there hasn't been a fully fledged American strategy for the Middle East. I think that's where the president needs to go now. If you liken it to what President Truman did when communism was on the march in Eastern Europe in the late 1940s, he issued the Truman Doctrine, which essentially said, we will not let Greece go communist. We will not let Turkey go communist. Well, there ought to be an Obama Doctrine, and his successors are going to have to embrace it, which would say, we will not allow Iran to go nuclear. So that would have to include a firm, unequivocal pledge by the United States that if Iran violated the nuclear agreement and drove towards a nuclear weapon, the United States would use military force to prevent that from happening. That would include, Todd, some of the other elements that I've mentioned. The United States needs to lead a coalition of countries, the Arab states, Turkey, our European and Asian allies, to re-sanction Iran should it violate the agreement, and we need to build up Israel and the Arab states. That would be a American strategy for the Middle East.
Now, one thing that could be on the upside here within what you're talking about, some senators have made the argument, as imperfect as this deal is now, is that with this international agreement, if Iran does cheat 8, 10, 15 years out, the world will be united against Iran. The American argument at that time to attack or to knock out Iran's nuclear capability with a military strike, that support will be there and the world will be unified. The United States will be right. Iran will be viewed as wrong. And our political position at that point would be stronger even than it is now.
It would be theoretically stronger. But in reality, what's going to happen in the next couple of months when this deal goes forward, all the sanctions that have been imposed against Iran will be taken off. And so you'll have these big trading relationships resume between Japan and South Korea and India to buy Iranian oil and gas. China's going to go into Iran in a big way. So I think the problem is in the out years, 10, 15 years from now, should the Iranians cheat then, and they've cheated in the past, so we have to expect this, I'm not sure it's going to be easy to put together a sanctions regime when the major global economies will be trading again with Iran. And this gets back to something that's critical at the center of this, American leadership. We're the only country that can pull together a big coalition. But in a way, the bigger battles are ahead. We've got to contain Iranian power. That's going to require active involvement by the United States politically and diplomatically.
Let me bring you back to the shorter term for 1 minute before we let you go, Ambassador Nick Burns. In the short term, one of the major concerns of both Republicans and Democrats is that when these sanctions are lifted, the ones that you're talking about, Iran will have a lot of income coming in. Some say $100 billion, maybe more realistically, $50 billion. And that some of this money will go toward its terrorist activities, its anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Saudi activities, destabilizing the Middle East. This claim has troubled me to some degree because I wonder right now if Iran's activities are limited by finances, meaning would they love to be giving more support to Hezbollah or to Assad or to other groups around the Middle East, but they just can't because they don't have the money? If they have more money, do these things get worse?
I think some of the sanctions relief, some of the billions, will certainly go to the Iranian economy, which has been depressed for many years, and the Iranian people need to see an improvement in their standard of living. But here's the problem. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is a very influential part of the Iranian government, supported by the Supreme Leader of Iran. They're the ones who are funneling arms to Hezbollah and Hamas, that are instigating the war in Syria, that have fueled the civil war in Yemen by supporting the Houthi rebels. So I think we have to assume that some of these billions will go to fund the Revolutionary Guards, which gets back to, I think, the major proposal. The United States needs to push the Iranians back, not militarily, but by a coalition of countries to try to close off their avenues of support to some of these terrorist groups in the Middle East. And that means that the U.S. has to be at the center of this coalition to contain the Iranians until Iran changes, whenever that happens.
A victory for President Obama, it seems, coming in Congress over the Iran nuclear deal, but that is just step one of a years-long effort that Ambassador Nicholas Burns says we need to undertake to contain Iran and make sure now that they don't go nuclear. Ambassador Nicholas Burns, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.